We're going to talk to Dr. Andy Griffiths this morning. He is a police detective and a professor of crime out in the UK. And let's see here. Here we go. Oh, my goodness. Andy, is that you?
It is me.
Oh, hello. I thought we were going to be plagued by the phone gods this morning. This is Dr. Andrew Thomas Griffiths, who is from the UK. He said I can call him Andy. Andy, good morning. Thanks for joining us. You're in Sussex, I think, right?
That's right, Southern England. Yeah.
Locate that for me. Where in relation to London? That's where.
Yeah, so south of London and north of Brighton.
Okay, all right. I have so many questions to ask you, and I want to start. You know, folks here in the United States, Americans are fascinated by what they perceive to be British policing, and I think it goes back to the constables, and they were reading Sherlock Holmes stories. And in my time, it's notable to Americans that the bobbies, and I think I know the reason that they're called bobbies. We'll save that for a more boring interview. Patrolled without sidearms, without firearms, and that was always fascinating to Americans. And I'm sure that's not exactly the same. And now, what about that? In reverse, what do the British people think about American policing? That was actually a question. Go for it.
Yeah, so the origin of the British police being unarmed, by my understanding from my training, was that when the policing started in the 19th century, it was to distinguish the civil police from the army that had been used to quell protests before. So it was a deliberate decision that the police would not be armed.
Uh-huh.
And then that became a tradition and remains so to this day, and police are still in favor of that. I need to qualify that by saying that these are very different times. And, you know, in my own force of Sussex and in every force in the country, there are armed response vehicles which can reach an incident within minutes. So, you know, in response to the heightened terrorism threat in particular, there are armed officers available on the streets of Britain today. But you will not see your average officer walking around with a sidearm, but they will have pepper spray and some will have tasers.
Yeah. Dr. Andy Griffiths is talking to us. Doctor, you were you said to call Andy. I'll be less formal. I know that we're working on schedules and having you on, and I think you were teaching yesterday at this time, correct?
That's right.
What were you teaching?
So I was doing a 2-day workshop with British detectives in a local force who had been selected for the highest level of interview training given out by the force, and they have me in as an external expert on certain subjects. So I worked with them for 2 days on their communication skills, their questioning, the way in which they deal with lawyers in interview as part of a 3-week course.
This is very interesting. Listen, in full disclosure, I had a couple of uncles who were police detectives here in near Chicago in a city called Gary, which people listening to me probably know. I'm imagining their interrogation techniques, and I'm guessing that yours are a little bit different. So we read a letter to the editor that you wrote to the Sun Times talking about sleep deprivation and some other stuff.
Yeah.
Why don't we jump in there? The Police and Criminal Evidence Act is a UK law, which apparently revolutionized everything. What's that about, and when did that pass?
Okay, so that's why the editorial in the Chicago sometimes so intrigued me, because it seemed to suggest that deciding on the extent of sleep deprivation that was not unfair was some sort of difficult problem, and it's not. It really isn't. So the UK, prior to 1984, the UK was very similar to the US in terms of confessions were a mainstay of prosecution cases. There were no real rules around the way in which suspects were treated. So extended questioning, sleep deprivation, even physical assault was difficult to detect. And then we had a number of cases which blew that apart. And in particular, a juvenile in London who confessed to the murder of an individual. And it was proved that he didn't do it. And that case sort of made the law change, to cut a very long story short. Now, this was also the time of the Birmingham Six and the Guildford Four. This is the IRA terrorism cases. But it was actually the treatment of a single juvenile, 17-year-old juvenile, that led to a change in the law. For listeners who are interested, that's known as the Maxwell Confey case, and you can find it by Googling that. And that led to this act called PACE. And what PACE did was to really regularize the way in which suspects would be treated once they were brought into police custody. And that included this rule that if you're in custody being investigated for 24 hours, 8 hours of that must be rest. There's nothing you could be asked to do in terms of standing on an ID procedure, giving samples, or being interviewed within that 8 hours. And that is sacrosanct. And that went alongside a whole host of other rules, including that every part of, and I call them interviews, but every time you're questioned, it would be audio recorded. You would be able to have a copy of that audio recording, and you were entitled to have a lawyer present when you were questioned.
This is Dr. Andy Griffiths talking to us from the UK. He is an expert in, I'm assuming, what is your doctorate in, sir? Is that criminology or something? What would we...
It's in applied psychology, and okay. It was actually, I evaluated the quality of major crime suspect and witness interviews.
Okay. Those of us that may be listening to me in Chicago remember this really unfortunate sequence of events. And Andy, I don't know if you do, but there was a police commander here in Chicago. His name is John Burge. And they just tortured suspects to get confessions out of them. Just really horrible stuff. Many, many, many false confessions and just awful behavior. And obviously that makes the whole system corrupt. Talk about corruption in seeking a confession in the ethics part of that. Go ahead.
Yeah, so there's a number of aspects to that. So you have the individual corrupt officers and corrupt police units that do not care about individuals and will get any result. But then you also have, and I think this is the vast majority of that, of well-intentioned people who make mistakes. And again, what we've seen in numerous countries over the years is this issue where police officers fall victim to confirmation bias, where they genuinely believe that the person in front of them has committed the crime. And that belief is based on incorrectly evaluating evidence, and therefore it results in poor behavior by the police officer.
Confirmation bias, is that what you said?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Go ahead. I just want to make sure because that's so important. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is a strong feature of most miscarriages. If I take the UK example, that I mentioned, the juvenile, the officers in that case came to believe that the juveniles they were looking at were responsible. So then their questioning and the way in which they did their other inquiries on the case were all framed by that belief. And the way and that still happens today. What happens is that you have a hunch that you've got a suspect. So when you go and see a witness, if that witness says something that's contradictory, they become a poor witness. Mm-hmm. Whereas if they say something that follows your hunch, they become a really good witness. And then when you write the file up for the prosecuting lawyer, you evaluate the witnesses by that frame of reference. And it's sort of insidious and unconscious among some officers who are low skilled. And this is where the training, I mentioned in the letter, in our correspondence, your colleague mentioned that, PACE didn't change the attitude of police officers. PACE put a new set of rules that were very clear. The problems continued after PACE. It took another 10 years of training programs to try and educate police officers that these hunch beliefs are often wrong. And so there's a combination of things. You need strong rules to protect suspects. You need good training for police officers. And then you need to back them up by good investigation support. And I'll let you ask another question, but I'll come back to that if you want me to.
No, I would. PACE stands for Police and Criminal Evidence Act. I want to make clear that's what we're talking about. I think this is it's so relevant and important right now. this unfortunate situation happening in the United States, Breonna Taylor's death, and we just got the word yesterday that they're not going to indict the two officers who were actually responsible for her death. Anyway, the spotlight is on police behavior and, I don't know, things like body cameras, things of that nature. So, Annie, but when you're talking to police officers, do they see you as somebody trying to help them do their jobs, or somebody who's going to catch them doing something wrong? What's your relationship with them?
No, it's good. I mean, I've done a fair bit of work in the States, and you know, I think that my position as an ex-30-year officer, as well as someone who studied this, you know, gives me that unique relationship when I go into a room and talk about cases that I've run. So I'm non-threatening, and also it's important to acknowledge that this is, you know, a heck of a difficult job, and officers are faced with these instant decisions very often that put them in difficult positions. For example, take rape, sexual assault. Now, you know, it's a worldwide problem that, whereas 20 years ago, when forensics were in, you know, not as good as they were now, that the issue with rape was, had sex taken place. Whereas now, in 95% of cases, when I speak to officers in every country, whether it's China or Lebanon, I've lectured all over the place, the same issue. Everyone acknowledges that sex has taken place because they know DNA is so good. And then the issue becomes consent. And then it really, how on earth do you work out who to believe between two people, which is, let's say, a Tinder date that's gone wrong? You know, so officers are in a dilemma with some of these investigative situations, because in actual fact, it's very difficult to establish ground truth in certain situations, however well you interview.
Do you feel in general, though, that we're getting more justice now because of forensics, because of all the things that we've talked about? Go ahead.
Right, that's a really great question. I certainly think that the standards of evidence available to courts to make their decisions is much higher. You know, take, for example, just phone data and CCTV and DNA. You know, you now have forensic proof of where people are at certain times of their journey, you know, from location to location. And this is the type of stuff that police forces should be accessing to supplement their investigations, and not just relying on trying to persuade someone to tell you what they've done or where they've been. That type of investigative corroboration is a mainstay of British police detective work now. And I have to say, what I have noticed in talking to American officers is that because the police forces are smaller, they lack the ability to liaise with large cell phone providers and network providers in the same way that the bigger police forces in the UK do. So if I say to you, in the UK, that there are three main cell phone providers, network providers, and there's 43 forces in the UK, and they've got signed protocols with those providers about how and when data will be provided in support of police investigations. That doesn't exist in the States.
Yeah. You know, I've only been in the UK once, and I was there a number of years ago, and I was standing in front of number 10 Downing Street, and with a heavily armed complex. That's, of course, the UK's version of the White House here. And back to your point about the first thing I asked you about, you know, whether the British police officer is armed or not, all these things. Let me ask you this. When you've worked with American police officers, is there any fundamental difference in the way that they think or grew up or their approach to policing? Some different frame of reference, difference between American cops and British cops? Comment?
No, I'd go wider than that. I think that police officers everywhere, when I speak to them, you know, in numerous countries, they all face the same challenges. You know, there's always too much work. There's always difficult and risky situations they face. So in that, they share you know, a universal approach and a universal desire to try and do the best they can. That's what I found. However, you know, things like training, accreditation, career specialisms, they're all different, and they do give different outlooks to people. Definitely.
I was going to say, you know, my impression, were you on the London force yourself?
No.
Which I'm
so
sorry.
My force, to just give you an example, my force, Sussex, an area of about 2 million residents, the county, and our force was about 5,000 in total, civilian and sworn officers. Again, different blend of non-sworn and sworn staff. The homicide unit that I ran, major crime team that I ran, for example, had 125 staff. That's the type of size of unit we're talking about. So that's the makeup of pretty much an average police force. Obviously, the metropolitan is bigger, some are smaller, but that's a pretty good profile of a general UK force.
Interesting. I just read a series of cities that have had protests here over the Breonna Taylor thing, and I mean there are just a lot of different. It's not only a lot of different cities, a lot of different policing. Then you get up into suburban police forces, smaller. I'm not trying to bring on any criticism from anybody, but some of the training is almost non-existent. Some of the smaller forces. I mean, we just have people that should not be police officers, and we're seeing a lot of that now. Let me ask you that: as I'm sure any observer in the UK would say, wow. I mean, pick anything, George Floyd, any of these cases, and conclude that some of the officers involved just should not have been cops. How often does something like that come up in the UK?
Well, you know, we get complaints about police conduct, and there's a national complaints group, the IOPC, they're now called, about various iterations of their name and role, but anyone can complain to them about treatment. And in the aftermath of the George Floyd issue, you know, those protests went international, and we had instances of social media images of police officers using force on individuals that they were then complaining about. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm never going to paint a picture of perfection, but I do. My own experience tells me that the UK police training, I think, is of a high quality. And I think it's linked to the size of some of these agencies. I think when you've got small agencies with a local budget, you've got a number of things. It's very difficult to set a minimum standard, and it's very difficult to have the pools of people to train to that standard. You know, when you have economies of scale for training initiatives and training courses, you know, you can raise the quality. And I think that is an issue for me in some of what I've seen, the difference between the smaller and the bigger agency.
This is Dr. Andy Griffiths. Andy, you've been fabulous to come on. It's actually already Friday. I had you on so long. you get to the UK. I'm sorry, you get to the US. You must occasion. Can we take you out? Can we take you out for a meal in Chicago when this is over?
Yeah, I'd love that. I've not been to Chicago, but I think, you know, the thing about this for me, right, the main message for me and why I wrote to the Chicago Sun-Times was that people don't need to be isolationist about their approach to these things. There is good science that supports what's harmful and what's not harmful in terms of civil rights and suspects' rights, and also in what techniques work and what don't. What gets in the way is politics and culture. So I'm always up for a debate on these things. And as someone who's done the job for 30 years and retired now doing this, we can help people to do things better for justice, you know, to get the right number of convictions, but also to treat people properly. And what I'd maybe finish on saying is that, as I put in the editorial letter, look, false confessions are not an issue in the UK now. Fact that the rules provided to suspects, I think, have improved the reputation of the police, because people in custody and those who care for them know that when you go into a police station, there are rules, there are videos that support the rules, you know, and you can get hold of the records. I think those types of things help everyone by making the picture very clear.
Well, it certainly, I referenced John Burge, the poster boy for false confessions here in Chicago. I'm really indebted for you for giving us time and for putting the right face on something. I told you that I had uncles who were cops. 99% of the cops I know are public servants and want to do the right thing. And I think that sounds to me like you're helping people who want to do the right thing, in fact, do the right thing, which is the reason you guys have had the success in the UK. So, Can I invite you to come on anytime you care to? If you got a thing to say, you'll call up, and honest to God, we'll take you to the hot dog joint of your choice in Chicago.
Well, great. I'll hold you to that, and I shall follow Bleak Network on Twitter now. And I think the important thing about this is to get everyone talking. And I think once there's an incredible amount of heat in the protests that are going on now. You know, I've got good friends and colleagues in Seattle who I've done some work with, and take that as an example. You know, the police chief there who's just resigned, she had done a tremendous amount in relation to the decree that they'd been working under, you know, to bring in modern policing practices. And that's what is slightly worrying, is that in the heat that's going on now with the understandable feelings of some people, where we could end up losing some of the change spirit, because people were just getting to two opposing positions and not find the middle ground. And I think the middle ground is there to be found.
And I think you found it. I mean, I think you found it. And as we say, the proof is in the pudding. The things that you've done in the UK are... they're showing results here. If you're listening to this and you want to comment, leave me a free voicemail. It's 844-220-3300. We'll air it, and if it's appropriate, I'll pass it on to Andy here. You can contact him. Contact us. It's radioanything@gmail.com. We'll send your questions or your thoughts his way, and we'll post anything you need to contact him. Andy, thank you. Go ahead.
I would relish any questions from listeners. As I say, I try and do a little bit of stuff on Twitter just to get people talking about these issues. Yeah. So any questions, I will deal with them.
You sound like an extremely transparent person. So I hope if I'm ever arrested, you're interrogating me.
Yeah.
Have a fabulous day. Thank you so much. And be well, be safe.